I'm Joan Beck. I'm pastor at Bethlehem Lutheran Church in Portland, Oregon, and here for the week to do Bible study. How many of you have been here last week when my friend Nancy Winder was teaching Bible study?
We heard her just on Friday.
Just on Friday. Nancy and I call each other every Sunday morning at 6 o'clock to compare notes. This week, she's in Seattle, I'm in Portland, and so we have a ritual. Actually, I call her at 6:07 in order to compare notes and wish each other, bless each other for the morning. And that's been a long time. I met Nancy when I was in seminary in 73. We studied Hebrew together. And it was because of Nancy that I got connected with Holden Village. So this is a Bible study. If you need a Bible, there are copies on that bookshelf right when you came in the door. That could be helpful. This week, we're going to be reading, or probably for all of us, rereading the story of Joseph at the end of the book of Genesis. He's also a patriarch. So you have Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and then Jacob has 12 sons, of whom the second youngest is Joseph. What do you remember about Joseph's story?
The coat with many colors.
With many colors.
Dreams.
And dreams.
And bad brothers.
And bad brothers.
But he forgave his brothers.
But he forgave his brothers.
He was in prison.
He was in prison.
He resisted the love of a beautiful woman.
Yeah, that's what I was
thinking. Resisted the love of a beautiful
woman. And he still became a patriarch.
He still became a patriarch.
That's why.
Some of the reasons why.
Saved his family from starvation.
He did save his family from starvation. Yeah. So you have heard and you remember many of the high points and low points of Joseph's life. Starts pretty high as the devoted, as the son, the beloved, the favorite son of his father. And pretty soon he's in the pits, and it continues to rise and fall until he finally achieves a rather high position in the Egyptian government, where he saves not only his family, but a bunch of the Egyptian nation as well.
But then he was forgotten.
But then, 400 years later, he was forgotten, and slavery was the result for his people. So today, we're going to look at just bits and pieces of it and try to look with a beginner's mind. So as if we've never heard this story before, I'm going to read it out loud to you from a version that tries to stick very close to the Hebrew. It'll be a little different than what's in your version there, but recognizable. And we'll stop every few verses and talk about things as they come up and then ask some bigger questions that we can discuss. I'm trying to emulate my high school English teacher, Roman Anthony Vincent Borgerding, from Golden Valley High School in Golden Valley, Minnesota, in the 60s. Roman asked questions in class when we were discussing literature, and he didn't give us very many answers, and we had fascinating discussions. But he would always ask us also to improve our assertions. He would say, well, where do you find that in the text? And so we're going to ask some things like that. And if you have an opinion about something, also be prepared to say, where do you see it in the text? But let's begin with a prayer. In the midst of all the pushing and shoving among us, in the world and in the church and in our families, propelled by anxiety and acted as brutality, you have planted yourself in all your fidelity. You have placed yourself among us in steadfastness and abiding care, present in the day, alert in the night, making us all safe and noticed and cared for. So evidence your fidelity as to curb our anxiety, as to restrain our brutality, as to overcome our alienation. By your fidelity, renew us, renew family, renew church, renew city, renew world. Give us the safety to love you fully, to love neighbor well, in glad obedience. Amen. Come on in. Find a Bible from the bookshelf and a place to sit. This seat is available. The light is better over on this side, I think. Also on that. So today our bite-sized chunk is Genesis chapter 37. From is by Everett Fox. It was published in the 80s, and this is his explanation. This translation is guided by the principle that the Hebrew Bible originated largely as spoken literature, and that consequently it must be translated with careful attention to rhythm and sound. The translation tries to reflect the particular rhetoric of the Hebrew whenever possible, preserving such devices as repetition, allusion, alliteration, and wordplay. It's therefore intended to echo the Hebrew, and when read aloud, to lead the reader back to the sound structure and form of the original. Wow. Everett Fox did this on the basis of Martin Buber and Franz Rosenzweig, who translated the Bible into German using the same principles in the 20s. Actually, it looks like they did that from the 20s to through the 60s. And so he's tried to model his English translation on the kind of thing that they did in German. And so I'm going to read Genesis 37, 1 through 11, with some stops along the way for some comments, and then we'll have a good break for a discussion before we move on to the rest of the chapters. An interesting feature of this is that it uses the Hebrew form of the names, so that Jacob is Yaakov and Joseph is Yosef, but in Israel or Jacob is Yisrael. But I think you'll be able to figure out who the people are by consulting your own translations, and also because there's a correspondence between the Hebrew name and the English name. Genesis 37. Yaakov settled in the land of his father's sojournings, in the land of Canaan. These are the begettings of Yaakov. Yosef, 17 years old, used to tend the sheep along with his brothers, for he was serving lad with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. Now, serving lad is our connection to the theme, the Holden theme for this summer, the foolishness of God. What's your translation say?
Helper.
Lad. It's a multi-purpose Hebrew word, na'ar, that means young person, helper, lad, assistant, apprentice, and is also used for fools. So if someone does something really foolish, you're saying something like, you know, he's just a kid, he's just a fool. And so this says, that's what Yosef was, a serving lad, but maybe also a fool. We'll find out if it's the foolishness of Yosef or the foolishness of God as we go along. Yosef was serving lad with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Yosef brought a report of them, an ill one, to their father. Now Israel loved Yosef above all his sons, for he was a son of old age to him. So he made him an ornamented coat. What does your translation say?
Long sleeves.
Ornamented coat, long sleeves.
Robe.
Robe with full sleeves.
Tunic of many colors.
Guess what? This is a word that nobody knows exactly what it means. It's very infrequent in the Old Testament. It's used in three places in this chapter, where it says he has a coat, where his coat is stripped from him, and where his coat is used to take to his father, for his father to draw conclusions about what has happened to him. The only other use in the Old Testament is in 2 Samuel 13. Keep your thumb in Genesis 37. Let's go look at that. 2 Samuel 13.
I didn't hear Technicolor Dreamcoat anywhere.
Yeah, that's right. There's nothing Technicolor Dreamcoat. No.
But that's the most accurate translation.
Second Samuel 13 is a tragic story about David's children. He has a son named Absalom, as we know, and Absalom had a beautiful sister named Tamar. David had many wives, so there were half-brothers and half-sisters among his children, and one of his daughter's names, his daughter Tamar, one of his other son's names was Amnon, and Amnon developed a passion for Tamar and fell lovesick because he so much wanted Tamar to be his girl. And a friend of his helped him figure out a way to get her apart from all the other women, and he raped her. And then he was disgusted with her, it says, verse 15, Amnon was seized with a very great loathing for her. Indeed, his loathing was even greater than the lust he had felt for her. So he said to her, "Get out." She said, "No, my brother, for this wrong in sending me away is greater than the other that you did to me." But he would not listen to her. But he had his servant put the woman out and bolt the door after her so she couldn't get in to the man who had raped her. And now verse 18. Now she was wearing a long robe with sleeves, for this is how the virgin daughters of the king were clothed in earlier times. This is that same piece of clothing. So it's obviously a unisex piece of clothing. And what does it sound like it represents? If virgin daughters of princesses wear it, and if Jacob made it for his son Joseph as a sign of his son.
Youth and favor.
Youth.
Richness.
And richness. We don't really know what it looked like.
Status.
Mm-hmm. There seemed to be some descriptions of clothing in the ancient Near East around the same time that people say, well, maybe that's it, and maybe that's it. So one of them sounds like it has applique on it. It makes me think of Hawaiian quilts that have applique designs on them. Or there's also some that are made of strips of cloth sewn together rather than one big woven piece. So maybe it was something like that. And the word may have, this is all guesswork, but it may have a connotation of being ample in size, and that's where you get the idea of sleeves and down to the feet. You know, it was really a big piece of material. Now, the Hebrew Bible was translated into Greek a few hundred years before the time of Jesus because the Jewish people were no longer living all together in Palestine and speaking Hebrew or Aramaic, which came from Hebrew. But they were scattered all over the Mediterranean area. And they were speaking Greek, which was the language of commerce, just the way English is a language of commerce around the world now, and people from all over the world know English. People from all over the Mediterranean knew Greek. And so Jewish people needed to have a Greek translation of their scriptures so that they could understand it, because many of them were no longer in touch with Hebrew, their mother tongue. And so when the Hebrew scriptures were translated into Greek, the word chosen for this multicolored, ornamented, special, long-sleeved robe was holopoikilos. And the reason that's interesting is because that word appears one time in the New Testament. So hop over to Ephesians 3. It's also used a couple times in classical Greek, which I'm not competent to read, but in Ephesians 3, verse 10, We have to read a little farther, I suppose, to get the context for this. Paul is talking in verse 7 about being a servant of the gospel. Grace was given to him to bring to the Gentiles the news of the boundless riches of Christ. And to make everyone see what is the plan of the mystery hidden for ages in God who created all things. Now, verse 10. This word is in verse 10. See if you can guess which one it is. So that through the church, the wisdom of God in its rich variety might now be made known to the rulers and authorities in the heavenly places.
Rich variety.
That's it.
Mine says manifold.
Manifold wisdom. Manifold wisdom, rich, see, still, nobody still knows what this word means, even in Greek. But it has this sense of amplitude and generosity and maybe even excess. Although how could we have an excess of God's wisdom in all of its rich variety? This passage here is saying the church has to be multicultural because that's the only way we can get a glimpse of how manifold God's wisdom is. How rich God's variety of wisdom is. We're not going to have a grip on that, or any kind of suspicion, good suspicion, of that at all, unless the church is diverse and multicultural. That's what Paul is saying here. So that's just a little wordplay on how it plays out through the whole scriptures. It doesn't really cast any light on the Joseph story, but
an interesting sidelight.
I think it's an interesting sidelight. So end of footnote, back to Joseph. You can think of his coat however you want to think of it. It just did make him stick out. So starting at Genesis 37, verse 4. When his brothers saw that it was he whom their father loved above all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak to him in peace. Peace is a freighted word in the Old Testament. It is shalom. Shalom means not just an absence of conflict, but it means the presence of everything that's needed for a good life. And the story of Joseph's father, Jacob, has been one of looking for peace. He deceived his brother and his father early on, and he was sent away in conflict rather than in peace. He was living with his uncle Laban and trying to earn the right to have his two wives, Leah and Rachel, and he deceived his uncle, and his uncle deceived him. And so he didn't have a lot of peace in his life. When Jacob comes back to the promised land and buys some property near Shechem, it says he settled there in peace. And you get the sense or the hope maybe that Jacob's family is finally going to know some calm and some peace and some goodness in their lives. But here are his brothers that could not speak to him in peace, in shalom. So it's also the place for a commercial for my dear husband John's sessions this week. He'll be exploring shalom and how we live shalom in our relationships and congregations with each other. Joseph, 37, verse 5. Now, Joseph dreamt a dream and told it to his brothers. From then on, they hated him still more. He said to them, "Pray, hear this dream that I have dreamt." Oh, I have to tell you now. The biblical scholar Robert Alter, a Jewish scholar, says it's incredibly important to pay attention to the first speech that comes from the lips of any biblical character, because the first speech will kind of be their character in a nutshell. These are the first words that we hear from Joseph. So listen to what he says. "Pray, hear this dream that I have dreamt. Here, we were binding sheaf bundles out in the field, and here my sheaf arose. It was standing upright. And here your sheaves were circling round and bowing down to my sheaf." What does this tell us about Joseph?
Arrogance.
It's the only word.
Yeah. And he's how old?
17.
Do you know any arrogant 17-year-olds? Yes. And he doesn't have much thought about how this will sound to anybody else. I mean, he has no, what the marital people call, softened startup. where you are bringing up a difficult subject, and so you do it in a way that affirms your warm connection with someone, and then you say, and then by the way, it really bothers me that such and such. No, it's just, oh, here, listen to this.
But there's part of, isn't that a beautiful thing in him, that he's not trying to cover it up? I don't think he's trying to be a twerp, he just says it.
He does, yeah.
But.
That's what he dreamed.
But we know where he got it.
Which is?
His father.
Yeah.
His father has treated him special.
Yeah.
And told him and given him the code. So what we see here is the coming evil that we know is about to come is because the father did not understand the grace of God and did not live in the grace of God, instead favored one person, one of his children above the other.
All right. Keep those thoughts in mind. Verse 8, Joseph's brother said to him, would you be king? Yes, king. When there's a doubling up like that, it's emphasized in Hebrew. Would you be king? Yes, king over us? Or would you really rule? Yes, rule us? From then on, they hated him still more.
Poor guy.
For his dreams, for his words. But he dreamt still another dream and recounted it to his brothers. He said, here I dreamt still another dream. Here, the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me. When he recounted it to his father and his brothers, his father rebuked him and said to him, what kind of dream is this that you have dreamt? Shall we come, yes, come, I, your mother, and your brothers, to bow down to you to the ground? His brothers envied him, while his father remembered the matter. So my question is, who contributed the most to the alienation that Joseph felt in his family?
His father.
Well, let's hear the possibilities. Let's hear your arguments. Say his father and say why you think that is. I heard father coming from over here, but I didn't really said it.
Because of his favoritism.
So his father, because of his favoritism, is the one most responsible, you think, for Joseph being hated, more hated, and more hated, and envied.
Well, here's a radical one. Mm-hmm. The Holy Spirit.
Mm-hmm. And why do you think that?
His dreams are prophetic. That has to come from something other than himself. And it is laying the groundwork for him to be in a position to save his family in the future.
Mm-hmm. Are there other culprits or candidates for people or beings who are responsible for Joseph's
lack of tact?
His lack of tact. Mm-hmm. And?
Joseph,
yeah. You want to add some more to that?
No. Okay. It says it all.
All right.
Where's mom and all this?
Yeah, where's mom?
Where's mom and all this?
Actually, his mother, I think.
I think she's died.
Yeah, she died on the way to the promised land.
But he was a firstborn, wasn't he? Of Rachel.
The firstborn of Rachel. Yeah, I went back and reviewed the order, so just so you have the order of the brothers. Born to Leah, first Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and then Judah, fourth. Next born to Leah's handmaid Zilpah, Gad and Asher. They are 7 and 8. 1, 2, 3, and 4, born to Leah, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. Born to Rachel's servant,
Sarah.
Bilhah, Dan and Naphtali, and then Leah's servant, Gad and Asher. And then Leah had some more boys, Issachar, Zebulun, and then Dinah, the only girl that we know about, although in other places it says sisters, maybe sisters-in-law. And then finally, Rachel bore Joseph and then Benjamin.
And she died when Benjamin was born.
She died when Benjamin was born. Do you think the brothers had any responsibility for the alienated position of Joseph?
Oh, they were jealous. It was jealousy.
Jealousy?
They should love their brother.
They should love their brother.
You have 20 brothers.
Well, it also could reflect some of the animosity among the wives.
Speaking of, where is Rachel in all this? And it also, to ask who's most responsible can lead to an interesting discussion, but it also could be that they're all locked in position over against one another. The favoritism of the father and the specialness of Joseph is a strong bond that leaves all those 11, well, 10 of the other brothers on the outside. And so they feel upset about that, excluded, maybe marginalized, maybe endangered. And so they want in to that relationship somehow, but the only way they know how to get in is to kind of triangle with it and to try to attack Joseph.
And Jacob's feelings for Joseph may not even be so much about Joseph as playing out his own stuff. I mean, this guy wrestled with his twin and his mother's womb, you know.
Yeah.
He's been struggling since he was conceived.
Right. And he clearly had a favorite wife, and that was clearly Rachel, and she didn't bear him any children.
Wrestling all the time.
Wrestling all the time. That's why peace is such a big theme in Jacob's life, and why this is an ominous thing, that the brothers can't speak peace. They can't speak peaceably. Have you ever known anybody who can't even say good morning to you? They can't look you in the eye? They just go past you? I mean, this is what was happening in the family here. They couldn't even say shalom. That was the normal morning greeting, like, hi, how are you doing today? Couldn't even say shalom to him. So, what do you think the outcome of this kind of situation could possibly be?
More animosity.
Yeah. In thinking of our own experience in conflicted family systems, observing them or being part of them, does it generally get better? It generally continues kind of locked in place and...
Just one more piece in the straw, how the straws pile up.
Yeah, the straws pile up.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's one other little aspect, and that is we don't often tell our dreams to other people. Joseph didn't have to tell the dream. He wasn't constrained by any, nobody asked him, what was your dream last night?
Right.
He just said, hey guys, listen to my dream, you know? So by that, he's inviting their, right. I mean, what's the reaction gonna be? They're gonna bow down to you, no.
Yeah, you know? And the whole idea of bowing down somebody was really a new idea to them. This is a tribal culture, and they're used to everybody having an important thing to do, and people have different personalities and different experiences, but they're kind of all equals. There may be the father, he has more power in the family. The firstborn son has more power, but otherwise, you know, this whole idea, you don't even bow down to your father. You don't bow down to your older brother. They have rights and responsibilities, but they're not your ruler. So the whole idea of being a ruler to someone, what is Joseph's dream really about here?
Future.
It's about the future.
Sure.
His kingship.
And it's about his kingship. It's about political power.
But maybe he didn't know that, and he was just excited about this dream that he had. So he said, hey, you know,
what could this dream mean? Yeah, he was just excited about it.
Wouldn't in the pecking order, wouldn't sons of handmaidens be lower than sons of wives?
They were legally the same. So it would depend on the emotional bond. And you know, in the scripture, there's this tradition that the younger son takes precedence over the older one. That's very unusual and unexpected. Ishmael is born first to Abraham, but Isaac takes precedence for the promise. Esau is the firstborn of the twins, but Jacob gets the inheritance, although he has to steal it with the help of his mother, Rebekah. And so in this family, too, Reuben should be the firstborn, but we're going to see that actually Judah, the fourthborn, becomes the more important leader of the brothers, and this one who's next to the last is the favorite. So there, that's partly seen in the Bible as God being able to do a new thing, something that's
and that
not
rank doesn't mean anything.
Rank doesn't mean anything. The last shall be first, and the first shall be last. Even in the Old Testament, God was kind of getting started with that pattern.
So sitting up by the bus driver isn't a guarantee.
That's right.
But we also see, very realistically, I mean, we see the pain that it causes in families when this kind of disruption happens, or what Jacob had to do to get that birthright. God wanted him to have the birthright, but on the human scale, it was deception and trickery, and he had to flee for his life. So God's call is not without painful consequences. Now, please listen as we read along now to what exactly is the crime of the brothers. We're going to read what they do to their brother Joseph, starting with verse 12 in chapter 37. Now his brothers went to tend their father's sheep in Shechem. Does Shechem raise any alarm bells in your mind? In chapter 34 in Genesis, just a few chapters before this, the son of the leader of the Canaanite town of Shechem, the son's name was also Shechem, so Shechem from Shechem, had raped Dinah when she was visiting with some of the women of his town. And then he said, oh, I love this woman so much, I want to marry her. And so his father, Shechem's father, negotiated with Jacob whether Dinah could be married to his son. And it was okay with Jacob. He wanted to live peaceably with the people around there. And Jacob's sons, the full brothers of Dinah, weren't for it. They thought it was terrible. They thought what had happened to their sister was just outrageous. But they said, well, we don't want our daughter married to any foreigner who's not one of us. But if all the men of the town would become circumcised like we are and adopt our religion as sort of part of that thought, then we can go along with it that our sister will be married to a Canaanite. So that happened. The Canaanites agreed to be circumcised. And then it says, on the third day, while they were still incapacitated from being circumcised, the brothers of Dinah came into the town and killed all the men. And then some other brothers came in and stole all the goods. So Shechem was a scene of
genocide.
True. On the part of Jacob's sons. Mm-hmm. So Shechem is not really, doesn't have happy associations with it. The brothers went to tend their father's sheep in Shechem. Now, they may have kind of happy associations with it. Actually, their father said, oh man, we are really burned. We are really going to be vulnerable. We are really in trouble because of what you sons did. So Jacob knew that it was an ominous and terrible thing. But also, that showed us, didn't it, what those brothers could do if they were incensed and furious. So keep listening. Now his brothers went to tend their father's sheep in Shechem. Yisrael said to Joseph, are not your brothers tending sheep in Shechem? Come, I'll send you to them. He said to him, here I am. And he said to him, come, pray, look into the shalom of your brothers, into the shalom of the sheep, and bring me back word. So he sent him out from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. And a man came upon him. Here he was roaming in the field. The man asked him, saying, what do you seek? He said, I seek my brothers. Pray tell me where they are tending sheep. The man said, they've moved on from here. Indeed, I heard them say, let's go to Dothan. Yosef went after his brothers and came upon them in Dothan. They saw him from afar. And before he had gotten near them, they plotted cunningly against him to cause his death. They said each man to his brother, here comes that Lord of dreams. So now come, let us kill him and cast him into one of these pits and say, an ill-tempered beast has devoured him. Then we will see what becomes of his dreams. When Reuben heard it, he tried to rescue him from their hand. He said, "Let us not take his life." And Reuben said to them, "Do not shed blood. Cast him into this pit that is in the wilderness, but do not lay a hand upon him, in order that he might save him from their hand, to return him to their father." This is the firstborn speaking. So it was when Joseph came to his brothers that they stripped Joseph of his coat, the ornamented coat that he had on, and took him and cast him into the pit. Now the pit was empty, no water in it, and they sat down to eat bread. One of the commentators I read said that these pits were to hold water in the wilderness. They could be not, they weren't wells. They could have water brought to them and the water poured in there and the water would stay in the pit. They were impervious. But if they were not holding water, for one thing, they were too deep to climb out of. They were kind of concave shaped, so they didn't have a straight side or a slanted side like this that you could crawl out of. They were kind of round, and so there wasn't a way you could get out of them. And if they were empty of water, they were judged to be full of scorpions and snakes. And so there actually was a law in the Talmud, which is additional laws outside of the scriptures, that if somebody was thrown into a pit like this that was without water, his wife could remarry, because it was just assumed that the scorpions and snakes would get him. He wouldn't get out of there. So to be thrown into a pit like this was to become a dead man. But Joseph wasn't dead, and they sat down to eat bread. They lifted up their eyes and saw there was a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead, their camels carrying balm, balsam, and ladanum, traveling to take them down to Egypt. Now Yehuda said to his brothers, "What gain is there if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, but let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother, our flesh." And his brothers listened to him. Meanwhile, some Midianite men, merchants, passed by. They hauled Joseph from the pit and sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver. They brought Joseph to Egypt. When Reuben returned to the pit, here Joseph was no more in the pit. He rent his garments and returned to his brothers and said, "The child is no more, and I, where am I to go?" But they took Joseph's coat. They slew a goat buck and dipped the coat in the blood. They had the ornamented coat sent out and had it brought to their father and said, "We found this. Pray recognize whether it is your son's coat or not." He recognized it and said, "My son's coat. An ill-tempered beast has devoured him. Joseph is torn to pieces. Yaakov rent his clothes. He put sackcloth on his loins and mourned his son for many days. All his sons and daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. He said, 'No, I will go down to my son in mourning, to Sheol.' Thus his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites had sold him into Egypt to Potiphar, Pharaoh's court official, chief of the palace guard." There are steps in what happens to Joseph. My question is, what exactly are these brothers guilty of?
Jealousy.
They are guilty of jealousy.
They've lied.
They've lied to
their father.
Attempted murder.
Maybe they've lied to their father. They didn't really.
They created the lie.
They created a lie.
Deception.
They did. Deception. But notice how they let him jump to his own conclusions. They never actually said, "We know Joseph is dead. We think an animal," they didn't even say it, "We think an animal killed Joseph." They just put the blood on the coat and they said, "Recognize this coat," and Jacob leaps to his own conclusion.
Selling someone into slavery?
Maybe. There's a way to read this that says, and this is how I always learned it in Sunday school, that they sold him. But this time, read it with me.
Somebody else found him.
They were there talking about, what are we going to do? Well, we could sell him.
They were planning to, but they
they were planning to, but the Midianites came by and pulled him out of the pit, and they sold him to the Ishmaelites, or vice versa, I forget which is which. Right.
They sold him to the Ishmaelites.
And so they weren't even there when it happened. When Reuben got back to the pit, he was going, what happened to Joseph? He's gone. In fact, he says, he is no more. And then he says, and I, you know, what about me? I mean, he recognizes somehow that his brother being no more also means that there's kind of an end for him as well. But I don't know, maybe we could vote. Did the brothers sell Joseph to the Ishmaelites?
That's where the
stories are. Or were they somewhere else when some other traders pulled him out and sold him?
They went off to eat.
Yeah, they went off to eat. Sounds like they're not there. That was actually a revelation to me this time, because I didn't think that was the case. So they didn't even really do that. They were jealous. They did throw their brother in a pit. They intended to bring harm to them, but they kind of keep pulling back and back from the harm that they intend to do. They were going to kill him, but Reuben, the firstborn, says, don't shed blood. And then, well, maybe then Judah comes up with the idea of selling him. Notice Judah isn't so much like it's a sin to shed blood. Judah's kind of going, what gain is there for us? It's like he's talking about it as an economic transaction here, you know?
Do you think because Reuben, that's how the word
Reuben
said, let's not kill him, that he then was afraid because he'd gone against him that he could be a candidate to be killed or someone come to him?
You wouldn't wonder among this family, would you?
If he defended him initially and now he's gone, who's next?
Yeah.
I think there's awful torment for you too when you're being so angry you'd like to kill, but you really can't do that. So then, but you suffer the consequences of that level of hatred anyway. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, their continued torment is pretty high still, even though their hands didn't actually, you know, take his life away.
Yeah.
They're still struggling at that same level of anguish.
Yeah, I think that's a good insight. I appreciate that.
Maybe they learned something from having killed all those other people. Mm. Maybe that was why they pulled back.
Mm. We talk about passive aggressive.
Yes, they were.
In a way, we are, aren't we? Huh.
These aren't Norwegians.
there's another scenario though that plays out. I mean, basically, when we look at that at this passage, we say, well, how come? You know, and as you point out, if you'd asked us before the session, what probably 95% of us would have said that the brothers had done it. But what's fascinating about it is, as you pointed out, that this was oral tradition. For a long period of time before it was actually written down. And we also know that the 12 brothers eventually became the heads of the 12 tribes. So the other scenario may be that the oral tradition changed the story so that the heads of the various tribes were not guilty of this particular sin. That human nature being the way it is said, yeah, boy, you know, we as a Reuben, you know, we as the, in the tribe of Judah, we would never have done that. So therefore, it wasn't us that did it.
Right.
There was some misguiding it at the original, but.
We can actually see that happening in this text back in 37 verse 2, where it says, Joseph was serving lad or fool, with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. Not, it doesn't say with the sons of Leah. So there is maybe some, I was saying legally they're the same, but there is a little classism going on here, indicating the patriarchs themselves are a little less culpable than the sons of the servant.
Although in 49 they all get it, don't they, when they go through
they
and
did.
Describe.
And so this is one place where the commentators say verses 1 and 2 come from a different hand, a hand of an editor at a later time, trying to tie these different things together, and so provide some bridging between here and there. So they have, the editors, the priestly editors have their point of view that comes across in these bridging parts that they put in that may not be part of the story themselves. Now, I didn't say either that the story of Joseph in chapters 37 to 50 is more unified and connected, more written as a continuous flow than any of the things that have come previous in Genesis. So we have stories of Abraham, and they're kind of bundled together and woven together in some way. Stories of Noah and the flood, stories of, not too many stories of Isaac, but a few. And a lot of stories of Jacob, but they're memorable stories that don't have a lot of through themes. This one has through themes. We've seen two dreams on the part of Joseph. There are going to be two dreams that he interprets when he's in prison, and then Pharaoh is going to have two dreams that Joseph interprets. And so that's part of the theme. You also have the through theme of the brothers, the broken family, the lack of peace in the family, and will peace be restored to this family or not in the end? And so some people call Genesis 37 to 50 a novella. And in fact, when I was a German major at Valparaiso University, I set out to read the German novelist Thomas Mann's rewriting of the Joseph story, which was not just a novella, it was a big fat book called Joseph and His Brothers. So it is novelistic in a way that other parts of scripture are not. That's part
of it. Can you say a little bit about why people would have thought that Joseph was sold by his brothers? I mean, now I've been looking at it, rereading, and even in the heading of this section, in the
sold by his brothers.
Yeah, it says Joseph is sold by his brothers.
Yeah,
it tells us that, mm-hmm. And I don't see it at all.
At
here.
All. At no. all. It has something. We'll have to keep reading because you know, or you may remember that later on, the brothers pay silver. For
the
20 pieces of silver, which is the amount Joseph is sold for here, they pay 20 pieces of silver for their grain, and then they leave Egypt with their grain, and then it's found that the 20 pieces of silver are in their bags. And I looked in one place, I didn't look in every place to see if they say, oh my gosh, what we got for Joseph is here in our bags, or if that's just a link that the readers make. So that's a possibility, that might be there. But otherwise, readers have made that link.
It's definitely not in chapter 37.
It's not in chapter 37. Another thing is Midianites, Ishmaelites, they're actually a name for the same people, but they're names that come from different periods in time. So it refers to trading people, but it was like, what's a good example? It's like in 1800 BC, you'd call them Ishmaelites, and in 1200 BC, you'd call them Midianites, even though it was referring to the same tribe. So it's possible they could be the same group, but it doesn't sound like they are. So it's told from a point of view as they sound like two distinct groups, and this is what's happening to Joseph.
Ishmaelites, just about relatives. I mean, they came, they're also sons of Abraham.
Ishmael. Yeah, they're the descendants of Ishmael. That's right. They're the Arab traders.
Yeah.
They go through. Does this actually say they have camels? A caravan. Camels. Yeah, camels is another anachronism. As early as this story is describing, there wouldn't have been camels. So this is a story told from a later point of view with a few local color details put in to make it more familiar. It'd be like we were telling. It's like my mother used to tell the Christmas story to kids, and she would talk about hotels. And stuff like that. No, they didn't really have hotels. So to put camels in the story is kind of like that.
But I heard this story earliest from the Voss Bible storybook, and this detail was not present.
They cleaned it up?
It wasn't my family's fault.
Okay.
We got that book from Oxford.
Blame it on the Lutherans.
What Lee said about rewriting the story from a later point of view to maybe sanitize the role of the brothers who had become the leaders of the tribes.
Yeah, I think the forgiveness of the
Also think of this. Jacob's other name is Israel. Mm-hmm. And look at his grief. This story moves from tension to violence to grief. And at the end of this chapter, you have a heartbroken Jacob who is crying about his son going down to Sheol, to the place of the dead. And did anything like that ever happen to Israel as a people? Did Israel lose their beloved children to slavery? Yes.
Yes, when they were in captivity in Babylon.
And to exile.
In exile, yeah.
In captivity in Babylon. And of course, we think that the whole Bible was kind of put together around the time of exile. And so exile, being dislocated from your home and in a place of great alienation and risk, is underneath all the way that the scripture is told.
Right.
And there's a lot more pathos when you think of hearing this story from that point.
Even to the point as to why it was written down, and you alluded to it, is that, as I understand it, it was written down in exile because they were a people without a homeland. They were in another country. And so the writing down of their oral traditions was a way to keep them as a people within a people.
Yeah.
A nation without a nation. And so you refer to the editors. They would have been the learned within mm-hmm. the Jewish community, and they would then have said, okay, here's why we're writing it down, and now we're going to take those oral traditions and we're going to fit them in.
Right.
And the same way that we might take our personal life stories and decide we're going to write a book and publish it, we would end up organizing it in a way differently than we would write our, differently than what we would tell stories. So there's a lot of, when you have that piece in there and understand the coming together of the scripture, then some of these things really start falling into mm-hmm. place.
That's right.
With an understanding about why there would be some inconsistency and stuff.
Right. You don't want to throw out anybody's version of it. You want to keep them all, so you just let the discrepant details mm-hmm. stand there side by mm-hmm. side. You can see that in the story of the flood, for instance. Mm-hmm. Did 7 pairs of the clean animals go on and 1 pair of the unclean animals, or was it just 1 pair of every animal?
Mm-hmm.
Both of those details are in the mm-hmm. flood story, for example. We have only 5 minutes left for another large question, which has to do with the dream. Where is God in all of this story? Has God been mentioned in all of this chapter? But we have the suggestion that it was the Holy Spirit who gave Joseph the dreams. Where else would he have gotten those? Walter Brueggemann, an Old Testament scholar that I love very much, says, the main character in the drama is God, though hidden in the form of a dream, silent and not at all visible. The listener will understand that the dream is the powerful work of God upon which everything else depends. And there's a tradition in Jewish interpretation that says God knew that the people were going to have to be released from slavery in Egypt, but in order to get to that chapter, God somehow had to get the people down into Egypt.
That's right.
And so, but because Israel was a beloved son, you weren't just going to put him in chains and drag him down to Egypt. Instead, this Midrashic suggestion is, instead, you take his dearly beloved calf and take the calf down to Egypt. And then searching for his calf, Israel, Jacob, will follow down to Egypt. So that raises the question of where is God in this story and what is God causing to happen? How costly is the call of God? And I wanted to talk then about how powerful are your dreams. Either yours personally, how powerful are God's dreams that you hear about in your congregations, that you read about in scriptures? How powerfully has any dream from God shaped your life and your response as to how you've lived your life? Talk to me a little bit about how powerful God's dream is in your life. And what kind of trouble it's gotten you into, and what kind of blessing it's brought.
Well, I'll share a story. I'm not going to tie it directly to a dream. But this afternoon I'm going to be giving a presentation on exploring the gap between science and religion. And my introduction, I will talk about this, but when I first began struggling with the issues of Bible and God versus science and philosophy, I went through an experience very late at night at a mental hospital. I was working as a night watchman, not as a patient. Had come to the conclusion, I told myself that I would not believe in God if God wasn't real, and the only reason that I had a notion of God was because of the toss of genetic dice, and I happened to be in a family that was a Christian. And my young soul was really quite torn apart about it. And in the middle of the night in Bethesda Hospital in Denver, Colorado, I said, God, why won't you tell me whether you exist? And so that and some other ones that I'll share in the introduction plays out to what I'm going to be publishing in December of this year, which is the book titled Exploring the Gap Between Science and Religion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you. And that's helpful because I didn't mean that you had to have had a dream. I kind of was using dream as a metaphor of what promise from God, what vision of God's kingdom, or whatever has inspired you to take stands, to shape your life, to do what you've done. And how has that led you into trouble? How has that been a blessing for you? That kind of dream with quotes around it of God that you have been called to live as a congregation, as a family, as a person. And another interesting layer of conversation would be as a nation. So take it where you want. Maybe take it to coffee hour. But that doesn't start for half an hour, so if you want to stay here and talk about this.
Well, this, I remember this story with such vividness, maybe when I was 5 or 6 in Sunday school, with the cartoon characters on the Bible study piece of paper, you know, everything in bright blues and yellows and greens in the graphics on the page. I can still see those graphics, even though I don't remember the content. This story was probably the first one that just captured my imagination and helped me to understand the destiny that God has, that He works through His destiny, and of course linked with that was that my own destiny would be one to believe in God like these ancient people did. Wow. And so, you know, it's just images. I mean, powerful stories are so powerful to children. Mm-hmm. And this is certainly one of those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we don't see anything dangerous about this story. We probably even think it makes sense to children because children are tormented by their brothers and sisters. So it's not here something they can identify with. Think of the really deep things we're conveying in the story, like a time capsule that's going to open up when the point in somebody's life comes that some other things in the story start to make sense to them.
Although all those things are true, we are tormented by our siblings. But somehow in this culture, we are putting our dreams, literally or figuratively, down, and we don't believe them. The arrogance of this man was a divine arrogance that he believed so powerfully that God was speaking to him. We would put that down, that he was able to be much more than he ever could have been by himself because he knew God was with him in some sort of way. And we don't. And that's a tragedy. I mean, well, how different would we be if we were more like him? My siblings would hate me. But church, I work with a lot of churches that are just lost their vision. You know, we call it transformational or redevelopment. And they don't believe that God is present in their worship services anymore. You know, and how would worship be different if we actually believe God showed up there and is present there? I mean, that's what he was believing.
I would go a step further, and I would say that one of our problems with the Christian church, and anybody that's people that are familiar with what's happening in the Lutheran church or any mainline church, part of our problem is that we've tried to limit presence of God in church on Sunday.
Yeah, yeah.
And when we do that, that's what God is in there calling us for.
Yep.
I mean, that's the thing that he's talking about. You know, is that if you build a religion where you are comforted by going on Sunday morning and then don't carry out those lessons in your everyday action, then not only is it, in some ways, it's not only bad, but even good that faith transitions to that. Because if all that we're doing is to gather in large buildings, and in the way on the way to it, we drive by those people that Christ told us where we can find him. We drive by the poor, we drive by the homeless on the way to church, and then say that we have a worship experience and then drive home past them again. You know, Christ didn't tell us we were going to find him sitting at, you know, with the person standing in front of us preaching at us. He told us, you want to see me, go out and you'll see me in the poor. So that to me is the lesson that is coming here.
Thank you.
That is important.
And there's one more detail that I'll mention to take about you, and that's the one who does lose his life in this story is the goat, the scapegoat, whose blood is shed in order to give the brothers something to hold in front of their father, who's going to go crazy with his grief. And for 22 years, the father is not going to quite be in the real world anymore because he refuses to be comforted for the death of Joseph. So think about what kind of symbol that goat is. Mm-hmm. Saved by the blood. See you tomorrow, I hope, and have a good day.
Thank you.